Welcome to this podcast, which is produced for the Norwegian Youth Atlantic Treaty Association's annual Nordic Security Conference, which this year dealt with the Arab Spring, a decade later. Today's topic is Islam's role in politics in the Middle East and Northern Africa. My name is Mathea Reine Nilsen, and with me today is Jakob Høgild. Jakob Høgild has conducted research on Islamist ideology and Islamist activism in Egypt, Lebanon, and Palestine since the early 2000s. He has interviewed Salafi leaders as well as Hamas activists and Hezbollah officials, and has analyzed the rhetoric and argumentation of Islamist intellectuals. He finished his PhD just a couple of years before the Arab Spring, which, according to himself, has shaped his academic career to a great extent. Welcome, Jakob. Thank you for taking the time to sit down with me.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, I've invited you here today to talk about the role of Islam in politics in the Middle East and Northern Africa. And for those of us who are not as well-versed with this ideological stance as you, I'll start off with a seemingly simple question, although the answer might be complex. What exactly is Islamism?
Right. It's a very simple question, and the answer is quite complex, yeah. So, Islamism is a form of Islamic activism. So there are many Muslims around the world, right? And they have a faith, they believe in something, but the difference between ordinary Muslims and Islamists is that Islamists are activists. They want to translate their faith into changing society and changing the political system in many cases. So it's a form of religious activism to change society. And for most Islamists, that change entails putting the principles of Sharia into practice. Sharia being Islamic law, often translated as Islamic law. But it's not like a set of laws. It's a huge corpus of texts and principles and precepts and some laws, so which can be interpreted widely. So Islamism is about translating one particular definition of Islam and one particular interpretation of Islam into political practice. Within that definition, there's a huge variety. So on one axis, you have the non-violent to violent forms of activism. And most forms of Islamism and the big Islamic movements are peaceful movements. They're not involved in violent practices. But then you have some, like the Islamic State, like Al-Qaeda, and other groups before them, which have acted violently. That's one sort of continuum of difference. And then there is another between those who are quite modernist in their outlook, who wants to modernize society, and those who are more backward-looking, looking to emulate the practices of the Prophet Muhammad and his first companions in 7th century Arabia to as great extent as possible. And then the third continuum of difference is between those who are quite democratic in their practices and their discourse and those who are much more authoritarian. So along all these three different axes or lines, there are huge differences between the various Islamic movements. Lastly, I should say that Islamism is a modern phenomenon. It appears in the beginning of the 20th century, more or less. It appears the most important groups are found in the Arab world and also in Pakistan on the Indian subcontinent. So this is where you find sort of the roots of modern day Islamism, and you had no Islamism before this. So it's a modern phenomenon, quite strongly influenced by modern European ideologies like nationalism.
Hmm. Would you say it's useful to distinguish clearly between Islam in a political sense and Islam in a cultural and religious sense?
Yes. Yes, I would. And most Islamists are politically invested, or they want to invest the faith in the political system and in political practice. While, you know, the majority of Muslims around the world, they let Islam influence their daily lives, their spiritual life, private practices, and cultural practices. Then there are forms of Islamic activism that are not specifically geared to changing the political system, but that's nevertheless activist in the sense that they want to change the norms of society, the way people behave, and so on. For example, in the 1980s, you had Islamists going around smashing video shops and so on because they thought that what was sold there was immoral and it wasn't right. So they weren't politically active in the sense that they contested elections and so on and tried to take power, but they were socially active and tried to change the culture. So there's a gray zone here.
Hmm. How homogeneous would you say that Islamism is across the region, across Northern Africa and the Middle East?
We'd say it's quite heterogeneous because we have these differences that I talked about in the beginning. So you have everything now from a movement like Ennahda in Tunisia, which actually shares in power and which has, you know, said that it has actually said that we no longer wish to be called Islamists. You know, we are Muslim Democrats, but they have clear Islamist roots. So you have that movement, Ennahda in Tunisia, and then on the, you know, completely opposite end, you have Islamic State, which is still active. So and which is, you know, completely totalitarian and very violent. So, and in between those two, you have many different shades. So it's very heterogeneous. And within Islamism itself, you know, there is strong disagreement and hatred even, you know, between these various groups.
Mm. And how would you, if possible, relate Islam in politics in the region with religion in politics in the West or in other countries? Is it possible to draw any parallels?
That's a very good question. I think it's possible to draw some parallels in some senses. So some of those peaceful movements, mass movements that have joined parliamentary politics in the Middle East could be compared with some qualifications to Christian Democrats in Europe. It's not, you know, totally far-fetched to do it, even though there are differences, but you can compare them. With other groups, it would be much more difficult. I mean, of course, you have in the United States, you have had religiously informed, you know, anti-abortion activists going around and putting explosives in abortion clinics. A form of terrorism. You have had religiously informed terrorism among Islamists as well. But I don't know if it's really comparable in that sense.
Mm.
So both yes and no, I would say.
Yeah. Moving over to the Arab Spring more specifically, what would you say happened with Islamism in politics? What was the status before the Arab Spring and what happened?
So before the Arab Spring, Islamism in the Arab, Middle East and North Africa represented the only real opposition in many countries. And it was a real opposition. It was, we're talking about movements which were very popular because they had shown themselves to be, you know, not corrupt like the governments and the regimes in the region. For example, in, you know, countries like Egypt, Morocco, Jordan. So, and they participated peacefully in politics to the extent that they were allowed to do so by the authoritarian regimes. They were either grudgingly tolerated or they were banned in these countries. So in Morocco, they have been tolerated. In Egypt, they were formally banned, but they nevertheless managed to join politics through back doors in the system. They were popular among many people, not only because they weren't corrupt, but also because their stance, the clear anti-Israel and anti-United States stance. So they were perceived to be sort of an opposition to what many people in the Arab world see as oppressive Western politics, and Israel as a bridgehead for imperialism in the region. And of course, the issue of Palestine is very important for many Arabs. So they were popular because of that too. At the same time, they were deeply polarizing. So those people who didn't, you know, like the Islamists, they often really, really didn't like them. And this is because of at least two things. First, these movements have been, you know, quite secretive as a result of their the ups and downs in political history, and they have been subject to persecution and so on. So they've been quite secretive, which, you know, engenders suspicions on the part of ordinary people. You know, what are these people really doing? And also, they have been polarizing because there have been, you know, a number of violent groups across the Arab world in modern times. Small groups, small terrorist groups in Egypt, for example, in the 70s and 80s and 90s. But also big movements like, you know, the revolution in Iran in 1979, which ended with an Islamist takeover of the whole system. And then you have ordinary people looking to Iran and saying, we don't want a regime like that. We really don't want our society to be like this. And these are Islamists. We don't trust the Islamists. So both popularity, but also significant polarization. This is before the Arab Spring. Then comes the Arab Spring, and there are suddenly free elections in several countries, notably Tunisia and Egypt. And Islamists gain huge victories. In Egypt, the various Islamist parties actually gain, I think, about 75% of the popular vote in free elections that were widely considered to be, you know, free and fair. So it was, you know, a real boom for the Islamists, the Arab Spring, and it gave the lie to a widespread thesis from the 1990s that Islamism was a spent force and that it had failed and was dead. So it showed itself to be a highly active and strong force in these societies.
And have you seen, do you view that development to have continued until today?
So the story gets really, really complicated after the Arab Spring, partly because of the success of Islamist parties. So there has been no straight line from that time in 2010-11 until today. On the contrary, and I would say on balance, Islamism has lost much of its momentum and power and the window of opportunity it had. There are several reasons for that. So first, we can start with the backlash from the regimes. So the regimes across the region, the Gulf regimes, the Egyptian so-called deep state, the military in Egypt and other countries, they hit back against the uprisings and against the Islamists. So from this position of, you know, completely unexpectedly coming to power and this euphoria, they were soon crushed very strongly in Egypt, where there was a coup against the Islamist government in 2013. And subsequently, the Egyptian regime actually massacred about 1,000 people in a sit-in in Cairo. So this was really crushing the Islamist movement. And then they outlawed the biggest organization, the Muslim Brothers, and designated it as a terrorist movement and tried to get other countries around the world to do the same. And then you had the same movement in the other so-called conservative regimes, that is, you know, US-friendly regimes in the region, particularly in the Gulf, countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They supported the backlash against Islamists in many other countries, far from their own borders, because they perceived Islamism as a threat to their own, you know, elites, to their own power. So, you know, even a party in Tunisia, the Nahda, came under stress because the United Arab Emirates, you know, funded and helped people who wanted to undermine the Nahda movement in as far away as Tunisia. So there was this backlash from the regimes. Then there was also the problem that there was internal fragmentation within the Islamist movement. And this has to do with the civil war in Syria.
Hmm.
So you have the Assad regime in Syria, you know, trying to crush the opposition. The opposition in Syria, large parts of it were Sunni Islamists of various colors, not only the extremists in Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, but, you know, Islamists of all colors. And this regime tried to crush them all.
Hmm.
So
the problem here is that before the Arab Spring, Damascus and Iran, so it means Syria and Iran, had created and led what they called an axis of resistance together with the organizations Hamas and Hezbollah in opposition to the United States and Western imperialism as they see it.
And then suddenly we have this situation where the Syrian regime tries to crush Islamism. And this put Hamas, the Palestinian Islamists, in a very difficult position because they had been allied with Hezbollah and with Syria and with Iran. So they felt forced to retreat from that alliance because they saw that their own people, the Sunni Muslims, Sunni Islamists in Syria were being crushed. And they couldn't just sit there and look at it without doing anything. So there was this split among Islamists in the region because of the Arab uprisings, because of what the regimes did to their own population, which also weakened the movement. Hezbollah, the Lebanese Islamist organization, had been very popular and had lots of legitimacy because of its fight against Israeli occupation of Lebanon and the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. But since they joined the regime in Syria against the uprising, they also lost very much legitimacy, not least among Sunni Muslims, the majority of Muslims in the region. So in addition to the regime backlash, there was internal fragmentation. So, and all this led to Islamism coming under very heavy strain and ultimately becoming a marginalized force in the region. Today, they have been, they're really under harsh pressure. And they have been dispersed to a great degree. So in Egypt, it's where you had millions of people who were sympathizers and activists in the Muslim Brotherhood. It's, you know, more or less invisible in the public scene. And all the important people have fled, many of them to Turkey.
Mm. Mm. So a notoriously difficult task for you right now, based on all of this, what do you think the future holds for Islamism? Do you think that window of opportunity has closed, or?
Well, I think one should be very, very cautious about that kind of prophecy. I think that Islamism, because it's a social and political phenomenon, you know, driven by human beings, it's always subject to change. And therefore, what's happening now will certainly lead to changes in the movement, but not necessarily to its, you know, to its disappearance. So I think there will be changes, but Islamists, you know, will adapt or react in some way, which will lead to new iterations of Islamism in the future. What is worrying, of course, is that this harsh clampdown might lead to radicalization. We have seen this before. The Muslim Brothers in Egypt used to be also in the 1940s, before Egypt became, before they gained liberation from the United Kingdom. Then, when the military regime, the Gamal Abdel Nasser, you know, achieved independence and took power, there was a brief honeymoon, but then the military clamped down on the Islamists very, very harshly in the 1950s. And that led to a strong radicalization among young Muslim brothers in the 1950s and 60s in Egypt. So, you know, there's a danger that we're seeing the same thing today. Sisi, President Sisi in Egypt, clamping down real hard, putting people in concentration camps, jails, killing them off. That might lead to strong radicalization among, you know, some young Muslim brothers, and then you would have a new cycle of terrorism in the future, possibly. So that's a very worrying development. But I won't try to really prophesize anything. I remember when the uprising started in Tunisia in 2010, I was called by a Norwegian broadcaster, and they asked me if I think there was a chance that this would spread to other countries. This was in November, December. And I said, no, there's no indications that happened. So after that, I've just, you know, stopped trying to look into the crystal ball.
Yeah, understandably enough. There has been some talk about how the COVID pandemic enables this sort of radicalization of youth, because we spend more time on the internet, we're more isolated, and not just in the direction of Islamism, but other more extremist ideologies as well. Have you made up any thoughts about this?
That's a hard question, and I won't pretend that I know a lot about this. So I don't really know. I know that the COVID-19 pandemic has led to lots of conspiracy theorizing in the Arab public sphere, you know, on social media and also in mainstream media, like it has, you know, in many parts of the world, including Europe and the United States. So conspiracy theorizing isn't conducive to a sound public debate or to, you know, moderation in opinions. So to the extent that you find these conspiracy theories, that's not a good sign. But I haven't really seen anything specifically Islamist, but then again, I haven't been looking for it either. So I really don't, I'm not sure.
We're getting close to the end here, and I want to finish with a question that might be a bit personal, but do you have any personal opinions on whether or not secularism is a prerequisite for democracy in the Arab world? Or do you believe that democracy can well be achieved with Islamists in politics?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question. My personal conviction is I am very sympathetic to secularism. This is part of where I come from, but the history and public discourse and culture is different in many countries in the Middle East for many reasons. Not because Islam is pre-programmed to be, you know, against secularism or against democracy or whatever, but there are many reasons for it. But it's different, and trying to impose some kind of secularism in the Arab world today, I don't think that would, you know, fly with most people. And not only Islamists, but, you know, most people, most Muslims in the Arab Middle East are quite skeptical to the idea of secularism, not least because it's seen as sort of an, you know, imported goods from the West, which has historically not played a very good role in the Middle East. So I have more faith in a kind of democracy where religion plays an important role. And in that sense, I think this experiment that the Nahda party in Tunisia is undergoing right now, I think that's a very interesting experiment to see if they can pull it off, if they can survive as a party, if they can achieve legitimacy and the trust of other political actors in Tunisia, then that would, you know, perhaps be a viable model for others too. But the main obstacle in the path of democratization in the Arab world isn't, you know, Islamism. It is the authoritarian, power-hungry, power-sick leaders you have, whether they be monarchs or generals, you know, or Republicans. These people are the ones really hindering democracy today, and they have done so for the last, you know, few decades.
And on that festive note, we'll round this off. Thank you again for taking the time to sit down with me.
Thanks very much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced by IATA Norway for the Nordic Security Conference 2021. Make sure to follow IATA on Facebook and Instagram in order to keep up with events and publications. And visit our website, iata.no, or Facebook to watch the conference if you missed the live stream.